This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. Coming up, if you're planning something special this Valentine's Day, here's another question you might want to ask that special someone first. What's your credit score? In our Money Coach today, we'll hear about why some singles are asking this question pretty early in the dating game these days. But first, we want to talk more about those immigration reform proposals that came out of the White House and the Senate last week. There was a lot of talk about how the GOP needed something to connect with the growing number of Latino voters and those who soon will be voters. But we are reminded that Latinos are not the only people affected by this country's dysfunctional immigration system. About 1 million of the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants currently living in the U.S. are from Asian countries and backgrounds. So today, we want to examine what the proposals mean for them. To find out more, we've called once again upon Deepa Iyer. She is the executive director of South Asian Americans Leading Together, or SALT. That's a nonpartisan advocacy group for South Asians. She's here with us once again in our Washington, D.C. studios. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you.
Also with us is Miriam Young. She is the executive director of the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. That's a progressive-leaning group that focuses on issues of particular concern to Asian and Pacific Islander women. She joined us from our bureau in New York. Miriam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And they're both members of the National Council of Asian Pacific Americans. That's a coalition of different Asian and Pacific Islander groups, and they've been taking a look at this. So, Deepa, let me start with you. I mentioned earlier that of the 11 million people who are estimated to be undocumented currently living here, about a million are Asians. We don't generally think of Asian Americans as part of this group, but just tell us, you know, what are some of their circumstances? How is it that it happens that this group is actually not small?
Right. Well, I think there's this misperception that when you think about immigration, Latinos are undocumented immigrants and Asians are high-skilled labor. And that's clearly not true, because Asian Americans interface with every aspect of the immigration system, as you said. From undocumented immigrants' perspectives, we are looking at about a million or so of the 11 million being undocumented. And these are circumstances of people who may have overstayed their visas, their temporary visas. These are people who are doing immigrant labor. They are working as waiters. They might be working as janitors. They might be domestic workers. There are also people who might be high-skilled workers who lost their jobs and don't have any way to regularize their status. So we're talking about a range of people, family members, grandmothers, to immigrant laborers, to high-skilled workers who are part of this undocumented community.
But we also understand, though, that Asian countries have the largest backlogs when it comes to visas. Why is that?
So over half of the family members who are waiting in line to get visas through family members are actually relatives of Asian Americans. And the reason that is because we've got a family visa system that's just not working. There are caps per country in terms of the number of visas that are afforded. And people have been waiting in line for years and years and years to avail themselves of these visas. So we're looking at people from India, China, Philippines, waiting between 10 to 20 years sometimes to be reunited with their family members, to set up roots in this country, and to strengthen their ties to this country.
Miriam, is there anything that you saw in proposals from either the so-called Gang of Eight in the Senate, that's a bipartisan group of four Democrats, four Republicans in the Senate, or the White House that would affect Asians more than other racial groups?
I think the family reunification proponents in each of those proposals would be a huge thing for our community.
Let me just play a short clip, you know, to that end of President Obama talking about the family reunification issue. Here it is.
We've got to bring our legal immigration system into the 21st century because it no longer reflects the realities of our time. For example, if you are a citizen, you shouldn't have to wait years before your family is able to join you in America. You shouldn't have to wait years.
Miriam, does your group have specific proposals around that? I mean, how would you want this to be addressed? Would it be to lift the quotas from different countries, or how would it work?
I think that would be a start, and proposals like the Reuniting Families Act would lift the caps, would recycle caps that hadn't been used from other countries. But I do think streamlining and making the whole system more smooth and easy for our communities is what's going to be important. I want to mention that in a project that my organization did, we did an opinion poll of Asian Americans that was nationally representative and did in 9 Asian languages, plus English. 54% of Asian Americans indicate that this visa backlog is a serious or significant problem for their families, with about 40% of them saying it's very or fairly serious. So you're talking about 40% or 1 out of 2 Asian American families having some personal impact with this broken family visa system.
When you're talking about family, though, who are we talking about? We're not talking about spouses. Or is that correct? I mean, presumably the line is shorter for spouses and for children. Or is it not? I mean, who are we talking about when we say family?
That's right. So the family visa system is only for immediate family. So spouses and children get first priority. And then we have siblings and other family members, usually not cousins or aunts, but really we're talking about immediate family.
So are you telling me that people could literally wait years to be joined by their children?
Sometimes. I mean, we see that there are two problems with this. There's an administrative problem, right? So you file your paperwork and the department just does not have enough people power to process the paperwork for you. So you may be waiting months to a year just for the administrative backlog. And then if you come from a country that is large and there are many applicants, then you may be waiting based on this family cap. And each month, the department actually publishes a waiting list where you can see, based on the month that you submitted your application, how long you will have to wait.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about how the recent immigration reform proposals would affect the undocumented Asian population living in the United States. That's about 1 million people of the 11 million people estimated to be currently undocumented living in the United States. I'm speaking with Miriam Young from the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum and also Deepa Iyer of the South Asian Americans Leading Together. The so-called Gang of Eight proposal and the president also focused on supporting immigrants who choose to enter the STEM fields like science, technology, engineering, and math. So Deepa, what about that? I mean, do you consider that a positive aspect of this? Some people say perhaps not, because some people say that that contributes to a brain drain in these countries, which actually kind of depresses kind of the worldwide economic development, which actually fuels immigration. What's your take on this?
Well, we think that it's important to bring over people who are going to be entrepreneurs. You know, immigrant entrepreneurs are more likely to start companies in the innovation and software industries. They will hire workers. They'll generate billions of dollars in sales. And we know this. So it is important to make sure that we're bringing over students, we're bringing over people to work for U.S. companies. But at the same time, we also have to give them a path and a roadmap to get visas and to become citizens if they choose to do so, not just with high-skilled laborers, but also with unskilled labor. And so it's really important that we don't just kind of utilize and exploit labor, but that we give people a chance to set down roots and really contribute to our country here in America.
In the time that we have left, I'd like to sort of wheel it around. We've talked about why this is in the interest of the people who are currently in this limbo situation to address this, but I'd like to wheel it around in the time we have left and ask why you think it's in the interest of native-born Americans or Americans who have been here of longer tenure that these proposals go forward. Because some people would argue, you know, why? Why is it? Yes, while people can kind of understand the pain of family separation, you know, other people argue, well, you know, that was a choice that people made. If they made a choice to come here out of status, then that's something you have to live with. And there's the continuing argument about what effect that this large immigration flow has on the Native population and their economic opportunities and their educational opportunities. So I would like to ask each of you to reflect on that in the time that we have left. Miriam, you want to start?
I identify as an immigrant. My family came when I was 2 years old, and we were able to sponsor my mother's family. And incidentally, you know, my partner is sick today, and who took my kid to work but my aunt, right? So I think America is a nation that's of values and founded on the idea that we're all created equal, that we, no matter what we look like or where we come from, that this is a country of opportunity. So really, this is a moment of living true to our American values or not.
So you think it's a values proposition?
That's one. I think that's the deepest, most common connection. There are, of course, other, I think, important aspects. And, you know, even David Brooks from The New York Times has talked about the economic arguments for immigration and why we need a better system in immigration policy.
Deepa, what about you?
Well, you know, immigration is not a new story, right? I mean, we have been in this country, we are a nation of immigrants, other than those who have been here who are indigenous. And so it's really important for us not to look at this as something that's been just like a 10 to 20 year history of immigration. And through the course of our history, I think we have indeed, as Miriam mentions, focused on the values of strengthening families, of making sure that we have people in this country who can contribute to our economy, who can set up businesses, right? And so I think we have these values that we have had since time. And so we need to make sure that we are staying true to those. I, too, like Miriam, am an immigrant, moved here when I was 12, beneficiary of the family immigration, employment immigration system that my father availed himself of when he was an immigrant from India. And I can tell you that, you know, we are very firmly settled in this country. And for us, it's not a question of kind of having one foot here and one foot somewhere else. We are Americans. And I think that all those, whether you're a dreamer, whether you are grandmother, whether you're a high-skilled worker, whether you're a domestic worker, all these folks are part and parcel of our country and need to be given the same rights as everyone else.
That was Deepa Iyer, President and Executive Director of South Asian Americans Leading Together. Also with us, Miriam Young, Executive Director of the National Asian Pacific American Women's Forum. They were both with us today. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, people often talk about the struggle to get into college, but for many students, finishing is really the big challenge. Our next guest has some practical tips for students to help them make it to the finish line. But first, to matters of personal finance, and today we mean really personal. We're not quite sure how many people we're talking about, but it appears that there's compelling evidence that for a growing number of singles, a potential date's credit score can kill a romance before it starts. Debt and financial habits are becoming topics of conversation earlier and earlier in relationships, and there are even dating websites that promote the sharing of credit scores to help screen potential dates. We wanted to know more about this, so we called Jessica Silver Greenberg, who recently wrote about this for the New York Times. Also with us is Josephine LaBella. She was featured in the article and believes that people should consider sharing their credit scores as a way to find a mate. It is one way to find a mate, and they're both with us now. Welcome to you both. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jessica, how did you hear about this?
Since the financial crisis, I've often looked at debt and how debt impacts your credit. And so I was interviewing for a separate story altogether. I was looking at the emergence of the credit score as a kind of scarlet letter. And I was talking to financial planners, and they were telling me that they were hearing more and more that their clients were concerned about a potential mate's credit score. So that's where it began. And then the reporting led me to those kind of delicious dating websites that we featured in the article as well.
Is this younger people just starting out, or is this more mature people? Because you can understand that when you get to a certain point in life where you have a lot of assets, you know, house, kids, college, grad school tuitions and things like that. But your reporting seemed to indicate, and seemed, I saw more evidence that these were younger people.
They were. I mean, Josephine, you're what, in your 20s, right?
I'm 25.
Right. This was people who were starting out. And to me, it made some sense in part because when you're trying to get, say, a mortgage, access to credit for the first time, the difference between a low credit score and, you know, a healthy credit score, something above, say, 750, that can make a huge difference.
Josephine, how did you first come up on a date?
Well, I was out on a date and we had been discussing me buying a piece of property with a friend in Newark, New Jersey to flip the property. And I had been openly discussing this with the date, and he had mentioned to me that maybe I would want to, like, you know, really, really look at this, look at the other person's credit history and kind of think longer about it. And, you know, I trust the person I wanted to do this with, so I didn't really think about it. And then he just blurted out the credit score. And I was sitting there kind of looking at him like, okay, well, if you're going to blurt out your credit score, I'll tell you mine. And rather than him look at me like I was crazy, it ended up having a really productive conversation. And it ended up that we were able to have a very trusting friendship as a result.
But this wasn't a romantic interest.
It was, and then it turned otherwise. So.
But could it have been because you both blurted out your credit scores on the first date?
No. It was more related to just kind of a personal work circumstance situation.
Okay, but how do you now broach this with people? Because is this first date conversation?
Well, actually, my current boyfriend met me in the midst of this is the girl who's being featured in the New York Times for her credit score. I had no chance to not tell him. It was the way I was introduced to him. And he has yet to tell me his credit score, but he's very respectful of the fact that I want to have a good control of my finances and to have a strong financial footing in a very tough economy.
Jessica, what are some of the other reasons that people told you that they were talking about this? And how are some of the ways that people bring this up?
The most shocking example, I thought, was this woman, Jessica LaShawn. She was one of the first ones that I found, and it was because she was blogging about how shocked she was that someone had asked her credit score over dessert. So the date apparently was going very well. She even had kind of was entertaining some fantasies about where it might go in the future, and then all of a sudden this question kind of shattered the romance. So that's how someone had the kind of chutzpah to bring it up in her situation. Because of the sensitivity of this, I think some people are more comfortable using the dating websites. And one of the things that I saw on these online financial forums where you can discuss any issue that you might be interested in terms of your finances, some people would say, look, I feel like a really bad person. I just found out that my boyfriend or my girlfriend has a 620 credit score, and I feel bad, but I want to dump them. And some of those reasons that kind of unspooled in the conversation online were related to things like, I want to be able to get an auto loan, for instance. You know, I want to be able to get a car loan. I want to be able to get a mortgage. I don't like the idea of this person's finances being joined with mine and somehow weighing down my otherwise kind of good financial picture.
You know, I could think of a couple of ways to look at this. On the one hand, it certainly makes sense in that money is, let's just say, a big source, or can be a big source of stress in relationships if people have very different attitudes toward money.
Sure.
But a credit score is just one thing. Josephine, maybe this is a good a question for you, because this is part of your metric of decision-making. Is it, on the one hand, is this a way to sort of screen people out on a very narrow and possibly even fickle basis? On the other hand, if those really are your values, then maybe you should just come clean with it, right?
Well, I definitely like to consider somebody's financial place in the world when I'm dating them, but I feel that that's not an independent factor of their life. If somebody is unemployed but managing well, that's one thing. But if they're unemployed and maxing out credit cards, you're going to start to wonder what other bad behaviors are they going to bring into your life. If we're encouraging America's youth to be aware of sexually transmitted diseases, why are we not making them aware of their finances and their own personal credit history if they're not careful?
Jessica, what kind of reaction are you getting to the piece?
I've received two kinds of things. One, I get emails that say, oh, I'm so glad you wrote about this. Credit is a very interesting proxy. I mean, it's a little bit of what Josephine was saying. You know, the credit score, I think, for some people has become a way of getting a much greater picture of the potential date. Or they're using it to both understand that person's financial habits, their, you know, comfort with accumulating debt, whether they're responsible. So I got a lot of emails saying they also use the credit score in that way. And then, of course, there's a whole kind of torrent of emails that say, this is unbelievable and it's not actually happening.
Well, I think Josephine is going to tell you it is.
Right. Oh, well, right. But, you know, there's always those kinds of emails.
Jessica Silver Greenberg wrote about credit scores and dating for the New York Times, and she was kind enough to join us from NPR's Bureau in New York. Josephine LaBella was featured in the article, and she joined us from New Windsor, New Jersey. Thank you both so much for speaking with us. And Josephine, good luck on your romantic quest.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now we'd like to talk about education, as we often do. And we know that college students are back on campus for the spring term. And we have to assume that a good number of them are not feeling so great about the first term. Why do we say that? In large part because, as we've reported previously, the data shows that too many students are struggling not just to get into college, but to finish within a reasonable amount of time. For example, of all the full-time students who enroll in two-year institutions, only 30% actually graduate within 3 years, that according to the U.S. Department of Education. We wanted to find out more about what it takes to excel in college, so we've called upon Melvina Noel. She is the author of the book, How to Thrive in College. She is an adjunct professor at Montgomery College in Maryland. That's a two-year community college in the Washington, D.C. suburbs. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
First, can we get your perspective on why it is that so many students aren't graduating from two-year community colleges even within 3 years? Why do you think that is, based on what you've seen?
Well, I think it's because they're struggling. They really don't know what college is about. It's like when you go somewhere that's a foreign place and you have to learn the rules of the road, you have to learn the language. And college really does has its own, it has its own language.
I notice that you teach a lot of non-native speakers of English. You teach a lot of immigrant students or students of immigrant backgrounds, as well as American-born students. Are there similar things that people are struggling with, or are they different?
They're the same. Now, it's not the same in terms of non-native speakers have the language problem. But with regard to students come, they don't know the layout of the college. They just want to come to the first class. They have no idea that there's going to be homework. It's amazing to me. They will come without pen, without pencil, without paper. And I say this thing, I go, so you thought I would be serving tea and cookies on the first day?
You also told us, and you also say in the book, that a number of these students, because they are adult learners, are juggling a lot of things in their lives. They generally have jobs. They often are married or partnered, and they often also have kids. What role does that play in their ability to deal with the college environment?
It's humongous. This is why I really threaded through my class organization and time management. They have to learn how to organize and balance that life. And that's very difficult for them because you have to make a list of what you want to do. You have to figure out how to fit that college life as a part of your regular life. And that requires sitting down and making a plan.
Literally making a plan.
Yes.
One of the other things I learned from the book is that the role of mobile phones is huge in the classroom environment. You say that you often have spouses calling during class, and it's not an emergency. It's just what? Pick up some milk?
Yes.
That kind of thing?
Yes. A lot of us teachers will start saying, turn your phone off. And I'll say, well, turn it on vibrator, okay, because there are some real emergencies. But do not have your phone on. I say, and didn't you let people know that this is the time that you would be in college, that this is your class time? This is the first thing that you need to do. So nothing should be ringing anyway unless it is an emergency.
Let's wheel it around and then talk about the purpose of your book, which is how to thrive in college. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that.
Okay.
How to thrive in college. What's the first thing that you tell students to do when they arrive in your college?
Right. The first thing is you need to be present. And when I say present, they think I mean physically present. When you get into the classroom, you need to be physically, mentally, spiritually present. In other words, I always say you shouldn't be thinking about the fight you have with your husband or you have to pick up your child from school. You can leave all your problems on the outside of the door as if it's a suitcase. Leave it on the outside, come in, be there for the whole hour, 2 hours. Then on your way out, you're welcome to pick up any problems or anything that's in that suitcase. And that's a difficult thing for anybody to do, because and I can be talking and you can see that person is drifting off. Not because I'm boring or anything, but they're drifting off. And I say, come back to class. That is the number one thing. You paid all that money. You bought the books and everything. Be present.
What's the other thing you urge people to do? You mentioned organization is a big issue for people. And I think a lot of people who come from environments where their parents are educated, everybody in their family is educated, really can't understand what you're talking about here. And talk a little bit more about that.
Organization. Right now in my class, I require that they get a spiral notebook and a three-ring binder. And the reason is, here's what will happen. A student will come to see me in my office hours, and they say, oh, I want to show you this paper. And I said, okay, and I sit there. It takes at least 5 minutes for them to find that paper. They're looking through this, they're looking through that. I said, you should know exactly where that paper is. So if you have a binder and you put your notes in this place, the grades in that place, and different areas, if you have a spiral notebook for your notes, if you have a notebook for each of your classes, okay, keep your grades. Something could happen. The school burn up. You don't have your grades. You don't have proof that you made that score. So organization means keeping all your papers in a certain place, knowing where to put your hands on it, making sure your homework is where it should be, not at work. Many times students come, I left it at work. Well, what can I do with that? You're an adult. When you finish your homework, put it in your book bag or wherever and put it by the front door. And if you feel like you're going to forget that, put a post-it on the door that says, don't forget to bring your book bag. It'll work.
If you're just joining us, we are talking about How to Thrive in College. That's a book by Melvina Newell. She teaches at Montgomery College. That's a two-year institution in the Washington, D.C. suburbs in Maryland. Now, you use the word thrive in the title of the book, and you say in order to thrive, you have to get a new attitude, like the Patti LaBelle song. You say that you need to fall madly in love with wanting to learn. I mean, how do you do that if you really don't? Maybe you've been badly taught in the past. Maybe you've never had a great teacher. Maybe you're really only there because that's the only way you're going to advance on your job. How do you do that?
You say, well, I paid all this money. I stood in line for the books. I registered. All of these things you did because you wanted to come. So already there's a sense of love there, even if it's a required thing. Okay. The second thing I tell my students is to be present, present moment thinking. You paid all that money, did all of that to be in this classroom. Enjoy yourself. They're like, you know, sad or frowning the first day. They're coming from work. They're coming from home. They've been very busy. They're tired. I know this. I teach a 5 o'clock class. And the first thing I say is, you're tired, right? They said, yes. You're coming from work, right? They say, yes. I said, guess what? You're off now. This is your time. It's not a spa, but almost. Guess what? I'm at work. So who should be sad here?
Well, let's talk about you. How did you come to this work?
To teaching,
to teaching, and to having this kind of interest in particularly students who don't have the kind of gilded backgrounds that would make teaching easier.
Well, I guess because my mom said, after I had 2 degrees, my mom said I was a professional student. I love going to school. So, you know, I have 5 degrees now, and I just love it. And even when I wasn't in school, one summer I wasn't taking any classes. I went to the library and I was getting a lot of books on astronomy, astrology, because I want to learn about the skies. And people said, oh, you must be taking a course. I said, no, I'm learning this for myself. It's in me. My mom used to take us to the library and we'd get 10 books a piece and we'd have reading practices and competitions at home. And so it instilled in me, I think, a love for learning.
Isn't it hard for you to teach students who don't have that, since you don't even probably remember a time when you didn't have that?
No, it's not hard, because for me it's exciting to make them love it. And I don't want to say make them, but I'll say things like, don't you just love that? Did you see what you just learned? Isn't that beautiful? And, you know, in the beginning they're like, okay, this lady's a little bit off here. But after a while they start laughing, or they say, I get it, because there's a moment. I don't believe you can come in my class and leave without having a sense of something else. Energy, you know, that energy passes over for everybody, for anything.
Do you think that anyone can learn to love learning?
I believe it. Absolutely. You need something that's the right for you. We might have to find it. Okay. It's just like books. Somebody might say, I hate books, but find the right book and you will turn them on.
If someone is listening to our conversation right now and is not having a very good day at all, just got those first semester grades, perhaps is not happy with them, is wondering whether he or she should even bother going back, what's the most important thing you would want to tell that student right now?
Don't give up. Never, ever, ever give up. There's no reason to. You know, it's just like life. There are bumps in the road. Smash them down, get up, brush yourself off, and do it again. Tomorrow will be a break. Well, the sun will come up tomorrow. It's really true.
Melvina Newell is author of the guide How to Thrive in College. She's also an adjunct professor of reading and writing at Montgomery College in Maryland, and she was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Melvina Newell, thanks so much for joining us. Come in back and give us a booster shot.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. They say it takes a village to raise a child, but maybe you just need a few moms in your corner. Every week, we check in with a diverse group of parents for their common sense and savvy advice. And today, and I'm not being mean here, common sense is the one thing that seems to be lacking in what we're about to talk about, because today we want to talk about pop superstar Rihanna. In this month's Rolling Stone magazine, she talks openly about what she has actually been communicating to fans for some time now, which is that she is, in fact, back together with pop star Chris Brown. Yes, the same Chris Brown who pled guilty to a felony and was subject to a restraining order for attacking her on the eve of the Grammys back in 2009. The leaked police photos showed her with bruised face and bloodied lip. And in the wake of that, Rihanna gave a number of painfully emotional interviews saying she was done with the relationship. Now, though, Rihanna tells Rolling Stone that Brown is disgusted by what he did, that, quote, we don't have those types of arguments anymore, end quote, and that she is happy. But many of Rihanna watchers, including the writer of the piece, openly worry that Rihanna is naive, deluded, and even more setting a terrible example for all the young women and men who watch her every move. So who better to talk about this than with our own Leslie Morgan Steiner? She is a regular contributor to our Mom's Roundtable and the author of the well-received memoir Crazy Love about how she survived an abusive first marriage. She's a mom of three. Also with us is L.Y. Marlowe. She is the author of Color Me Butterfly. That is the story of four generations of domestic abuse survivors in her family. She also founded the Saving Promise campaign to raise awareness about domestic violence. That's named for her granddaughter, whose life was threatened in an incident of domestic violence. And for additional perspective, we're happy to have with us Oliver Williams. He's director of the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community. That's at the University of Minnesota. He's a professor of social work there and has worked with a number of groups, battered women's shelters, also intervening in domestic violence situations, and so on. So welcome to you all. Thank you all so much for talking with us.
Thanks,
Thank
Michelle.
You for having me.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
I just want to play a short clip of Rihanna talking to Oprah Winfrey back in August about her relationship with Chris Brown.
We built a trust again, and that's it. Like, we love each other, and we probably always will. And that's not anything that we're going to try to change. It's not something you can shut off if you've ever been in love.
Now, at the time, Leslie Morgan Steiner, I have to say that the implication was that she had a kind of a distant love of him. She kind of loved him at a distance, you know, and that wasn't going to change. But now it's become very clear, and she makes very clear, that they are, in fact, a couple again. And I was wondering, when you heard that, did you hear your younger self?
In many ways, I did. I heard the hopeful, naive part of myself, the hope junkie that was always convinced that my ex-husband would change, that he would never hit me again, that we could salvage the early greatness of our kind of fairy tale love. But I tell you now, as an older, wiser woman, I would not trade places with Rihanna for anything. She's voluntarily entering into an abusive relationship with somebody who has already abused her, who witnessed family abuse as a child. It's very risky what she's taking on. And I don't think that she is a role model. I think she is a cautionary tale. And domestic violence is so much more lethal than people realize, especially for women her age, 16 to 24. And in short, I'd say that Rihanna is whack job crazy to get involved with Chris Brown again.
Okay, well, tell us how you really feel when we come back to you sort of next. You know, L.Y. Marlowe, we're happy to have you with us because one of the things that I know was very painful that you talk about in your memoir was that your grandmother, your mother, you all experienced domestic violence, and then you were devastated when you found out that your 22-year-old daughter was in an abusive relationship, even though you had warned her. And I'm just wondering why you think it is that your warnings didn't make a difference.
I think my warnings did not make a difference because for the same very reasons, I suspect Rihanna's warnings are not making a difference. That young women have a very different perspective nowadays about what relationships are. But what's interesting, however, is having come from four generations, as you mentioned, Michelle, my grandmother, my mother, myself, and then my daughter, who was 22 years old, that warning that I tried to give her then led to her being killed almost twice by this person. The second time, she was strangled while her then baby girl named Promise lay on a bed beside her. It would be that story that ultimately inspired me to found Saving Promise about my daughter's story, mm-hmm. 22 years old, and Promise, whose life was also threatened by this person. His words, I'm going to bury her body where nobody could find it. Mm-hmm. So if that isn't warning enough to give me and now my daughter, who survived that, a understanding of how serious this is, hence the reason why I founded Saving Promise, to really get at the what's more important in this conversation is to really get at why this is happening and why it is not stopping. And the primary reason is prevention. And that's ultimately what Saving Promise is focusing on, particularly that age demographic, women's ages 16 to 24, to increase prevention.
So, Professor Williams, you've worked with both sides of the equation, if I can call it that. You've worked with people who have experienced abuse, and you've worked with people who are batterers. What is it about this aren't we getting?
Well, one of the things that I think is that, you know, we act surprised that what's going on with Chris Brown and Rihanna is occurring. And the reality is the fact that it happens regularly. So some of the literature talks about the fact that women leave and return about 6 times before they're gone for good. And I think part of it is the fact that they think that they may be able to change him and that they've done something wrong, when in fact he's got to take responsibility for what he has done, and he'll be a carrier for violence until he accepts responsibility for it. And I think the other thing is that people equate conflict and the natural consequence of conflict is violence, when that's not true. People go have conflict on a regular basis, and they go from conflict to conflict resolution, but violence is a choice. And we don't prepare people to think about the fact that it's a choice and that conflict resolution is something that people need to give some thought to, and that they're two different sets of things. I'm not sure we prepare our young people to be able to think about that in those ways.
Can people change, Professor Williams?
Well, I've seen people change. I think that the difficult thing is that I'm not sure that we have the answers in terms of research with regard to who does and who doesn't. You know, when I've talked to men and seen them by testament of their family as well as other key informants over the years, you know, I think part of it is what the learning skills that they might be able to get from a batterer's intervention program, the behavioral change, the recognition that it was something that they did that was wrong, rather than placing the responsibility on their partner. But I think the other thing is the fact that there's some insight into the fact that you can blame somebody maybe in the first relationship, perhaps in the second relationship that you're violent in, but in the third relationship, perhaps some men end up saying, well, you know, it's been her that I've blamed her in these other situations, but I can't keep doing that because I notice other people around me aren't doing it. Plus, you know, I lost people that I cared about, and maybe there's something wrong with me that I need to get straight.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about singer Rihanna. She's a superstar. She seems to be, and has communicated with her fans, and now in an extensive interview with Rolling Stone magazine, that she is in fact back with fellow singer star Chris Brown. Now, why are we talking about this? The numbers are huge. She's got 12 number one singles in half as many years, more digital sales than anybody in history, and 3.2 billion YouTube views, which says that people watch her and what she's doing. So we're talking about what are the implications of her decisions. Here, our guests are Oliver Williams of the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community. That's who was speaking just now. Also with us, L.Y. Marlowe, author of Color Me Butterfly. It's a memoir about her experience and 4 generations of women in her family and their experience with domestic violence. And Leslie Morgan Steiner, one of our regular moms, who also wrote about surviving abuse in her memoir, Crazy Love. So, you know, Leslie, let's just go right there. You recently gave a TED Talk where you answered the question that a lot of people have is, why don't you go? Why do you stay? And I think the reason that you're particularly positioned to talk about this is that, you know, people can't see you, but you're white. Many people may think that it doesn't affect white people. It does. And also, you're very well educated, very accomplished. So people think, what does she need? Why would she be staying in that? So what did you tell people about this?
Well, one of the mistakes that I made, which I see very clearly in Rihanna too, is that I didn't recognize that I was a battered woman, and I didn't recognize how very troubled my husband was. What I thought was that I was a strong, smart woman. I saw myself so much the way Rihanna sees herself, and that I could handle it, and that I was in love with a troubled man who I was going to help, and that love was going to conquer all. And I didn't understand that I was in a complex and incredibly dangerous psychological trap. And the Rolling Stone interview is fascinating because she says so many things that ring true with me, because she thinks she's strong, and she is. She's very successful. She's a very, very powerful person, but I feel like she really doesn't understand how incredibly, potentially lethal this relationship is. could be. And it could be very dangerous to her, and also it could just totally derail her career and her future. And I think that it's, you know, I think that's why we're finding this so fascinating to watch, is that we feel like we are watching a train wreck that's about to happen. And we know enough about domestic violence to know that, that it probably will happen again.
Well, we talk about race, so we raised it. So let's just go right there. Again, mm-hmm. You're African-American. Is there something about, being African-American you think may have affected your willingness to go to the authorities? Is there something about that experience that you think is relevant to talk about here?
I think there is not an issue of race or creed or nationality. I think it's an issue of shame and silence. That goes across any indicators of whether or not you come from a low-income family, which my family did come from at the time, or you come from, an upper echelon. It doesn't matter. The thing that matters is the silence and the shame that, unfortunately, we don't want to talk about. We don't want to talk about this as a society. So how do we expect a young woman like Rihanna or my daughter to talk about it and to be comfortable sharing what they're really feeling? I would venture out to say that part of the focus that has not been spent, and particularly around this issue, because the world is watching, because of Rihanna, leads us to ask the question, why is this happening so frequently and why are we not talking about it?
Well, we are talking about it, though. I mean, the fact is, this is one of the things that she's given us an opportunity to talk about it, even mm-hmm. though, one would not wish this on her. I certainly don't wish this on either of them, but she is. So what should we be saying?
I think what we should be saying is, how can we all get involved in this situation? I think it's going to take a village to raise a child in terms of addressing this issue. One of the things that Saving Promise is focused on, as I mentioned, is introducing a national call to action to create greater prevention, education, and awareness to break the silence and the cycle and ask America to make a promise for change.
Professor Williams, what should we be talking about now that we are talking about this? And obviously recognizing that, Rihanna's circumstances are different. But one of the things that is so fascinating about this is, number one, she's in everybody's eyesight on the one hand. On the other hand, there is very little we actually know about what's going on in that relationship. We don't know whether that incident that led to his being arrested, was that the first time? Was that the third, the sixth? We don't know. So many things we don't know, even though they are in the public spotlight. So given that, what conversations do you think we should be having? What conversations do you wish we would all be having, perhaps when we go home today, when we all go home today?
Well, I think the thing is, how do we communicate to people who are victims of abuse? And I do. Hi, L.Y. This is Oliver.
Hello, Oliver.
I think that the issue about making this a sort of a public statement to the community is something that's important. And one of the things that I think is that we don't have those conversations within diverse communities. And I do think that there's a cultural element associated with it in this sense, that sometimes when we have our conversations, people don't feel drawn in because I'm not so sure that they think that you're talking about them. In different African countries, there is no word for domestic violence because people are socialized to sort of see this as a part of the natural occurrence of what happens. The types of, when we talk about sexism gives men license to be violent, but we don't talk about different brands of sexism. It's not experienced in the same way in every community, although the overarching issue is the fact that it's subordinating women and it's putting them in a circumstance where they can be victimized in a particular way. But the question that I've asked women in the past is, if you were going to go for help, where would you go? And some of them will identify battered women's shelters. Some of them would identify other places. Sometimes churches are those places that people go to first. And many times they're disappointed by going to churches, and that's not the place where they're getting help. In other situations, that they are the place that absolutely responded to their needs and knew how to either get them to support services or provided support services after being trained on how to do it within their particular church. So do we reach out to those places that exist within our community so they're the first line of defense rather than the backdrop being, calling the police? And African-American women clearly do, even low-income African-American women call the police. Oftentimes they call the police in order for them to stop him, not necessarily in the relationship initially, But over time, they absolutely want to be gone. And it's safer, even though it's dangerous for women to leave. It's in the long run, they can be often safer for them to be out of the circumstance. So I just think, you know, where can we make connections in the community to talk to young men about their behavior, alternatives to violence, that conflict is not a natural circumstance that leads to violence.
I'm going to ask for a final thought from Leslie. Now, Rihanna says she's not a role model. She's not trying to set an example for anybody's daughters, but you've got two daughters as well as a son. And I'd just like to ask, you know, what would you like to say? What would you like to say to her? What would you like to say to your own kids about this?
Well, when people focus so much on Rihanna here and why she's going back with him and why she stays with him, I think that we're getting it all wrong. Because what I would say to anybody following this case, including my own kids who are watching it, is what about Chris Brown? Why isn't anybody asking, why did he beat somebody who loved him? If he does it again, we've got to ask, why is he doing it? And I think we take it for granted that men do attack women, and we somehow do accept that it's okay. And instead of asking again and again, as if it's her fault, you know, why she loves an abusive man, why don't we ask why he is abusing somebody who is so in love with him?
Leslie Morgensteiner is author of Crazy Love, the memoir of her abusive first marriage. She recently did a TED Talk that can be found on TED.com. It currently has some 400,000 views, so worth checking out. She was here in Washington, D.C. with us, along with L.Y. Marlowe. She's the author of Color Me Butterfly and founder of Saving Promise, a campaign against domestic violence. Oliver Williams is director of the Institute on Domestic Violence in the African American Community at the University of Minnesota. He was with us from Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Thank you all so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, Michelle.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.